the way we fund our municipalities with all these layers, the cities, the townships, the counties, is it balkanizing our state?
Our governments were created, just the structure of our governments were created 200 plus years ago with Jeffersonian democracy as the model.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, how to get more regional cooperation in Southeast Michigan. But first, it may have taken them years to figure out a way to fix Michigan's crumbling roads. But the state Senate moved at lightning speed last week to get rid of straight ticket voting. A lickety-split committee meeting in the morning, the full Senate voting it through that evening. 23 Republicans, 4 and 11 Democrats, and 2 Republicans against it. Michigan Radio's political commentator Jack Lessenberry is here with us now. Jack, the sponsor of this bill is Troy Republican Senator Marty Nolenberg, who says we, the voting public, should be focusing on the candidate and, is his words, not pulling a lever for a political party. And to that you say?
Well, he doesn't really mean that. What this is about is partisan advantage. The Republicans feel, with a great deal of justification, that they're hurt more by straight ticket voting. And there is a very recent glaring example of it. Last year's election, when Governor Snyder was a reelected governor, and most Republicans won, Democrats won 8 out of 9 statewide education board seats for the various universities and the Board of Education. And the reason for that was straight ticket voting. Well, what do I mean by that? A lot of people in last year's election voted mainly Republican, except they split their ticket to vote for Gary Peters, the candidate for U.S. Senate, because Republicans had a very weak candidate, Terry Lynn Land, who lost overwhelmingly. But when people split their tickets, they almost never finish their ballot. They usually vote down to about the level of legislature. But then there's all these judges that most people have never heard of, community college board seats, state board of education seats, and voters tend to skip those. But you cast an automatic vote for all partisan candidates if you do a straight ticket ballot. And on election night, for example, Cassandra Albrecht is a member of the State Board of Education, a Democrat. She went to bed convinced that she had lost. But what happened was when the votes were counted from Detroit, most people from Detroit just vote a straight Democratic ticket, and that managed to save her and almost all the other board members. So Republicans want to get rid of that.
So we would not even be having this conversation if most straight ticket voters voted Republican.
Exactly. In fact, there are some who vote Republican. My analysis of it, if you'd had this law in place, Terry Lynn Land would have done even worse because there are some people who voted Republican straight tickets. If they'd had to split their ballot, they wouldn't have voted for her. But Republicans would have probably won more of those board seats. And that's what this is all about. Of course, it remains to be seen what the state house will do. But there's other problems with this, purely aside from the partisan ones.
Mm-hmm.
For example, it would take much longer if everybody went to the voting booth and voted one by one for all those offices, it'd take 5 months. We have what sort of is called a bedsheet ballot now. We've got all these races, dozens of races, and the Republicans have also made it harder. They don't want to make it any easier for people to get absentee ballots. We don't have early voting that states like Indiana and Ohio have. So if you actually went in the voting booth and voted for all this, it'd be horrible congestion and chaos. So what you would probably do is having people cast fewer votes.
And we know the Michigan Townships Association, which represents local clerks, was very, very much against this.
Of course, because they people wouldn't vote for their candidates at all. And most of us, let's face it, I'm over 60, so I automatically get an absentee ballot. I cover politics. I've covered them all my life. But I have to call people. I don't know the people running for the community college boards in my county. I sometimes don't know some of the district judge candidates. And what we've learned is that when people are faced with those options, they do one of two things. They either vote for people with names like Kelly or O'Brien that make them feel comfortable, or they just skip the race entirely.
Now, we can't forget that the state legislature tried to get rid of straight ticket voting in 2001, and voters responded with an initiative and reinstated it. But that isn't going to happen this time.
Well, that's a very good point, and it indicates essentially the underhandedness of this proposal. I don't say that in a partisan sense. I would be condemning it just as much if the Democrats did it. There's something sort of crooked about this, and this is what this is. You're exactly right. They tried this in 2001, and the voters said absolutely not. They did a referendum. The Republicans have stuck $1 million appropriation in this bill. There's no reason there should be any appropriation, but they stuck that in there for one reason. The Michigan Constitution says if a bill includes money, it's not subject to referendum. So basically, they are taking the right to change this away from the people. This is sort of an anti-democracy bill on many levels. Now, of course, that's an abuse. What the people writing the Constitution meant was they're talking about budget bills, and you don't want to have statewide votes on budget bills. It would just be chaos. But we have a new practice all of a sudden the last few years of sticking token appropriations into bills to try to thwart the people's will.
Yeah, exactly. You said this is not the first time they've done this, and we're seeing this kind of tactic pick up.
They are. In the case of the wolf hunting thing, I think they had to withdraw it. There was so much that they were sort of shamed out of it. But no, this is a new Republican tactic. What we don't know is if this will get through the House and if the governor will sign it. There were two Republicans who didn't go along with this, and the partisan balance is closer in the House. The Republicans have, I think the current margin is 61 to 46 seats in the House. So if a few Republicans said no, it wouldn't go through. And there's also not many days left in this legislative session because they take long vacations. Most of us should have vacations like they do. And there's only a few days, I think something like 6 or 7 days left that they can actually work. So this may just die of its own weight. But we don't know. And of course, we don't know what the governor will do.
And bottom line, then, the party that's preaching less government seems to be sticking its nose in the voting booth.
Well, the party that's preaching less government doesn't want people to have much say about that government. And some Democrats say, with some justification, I mean, they've gerrymandered the districts to give Republicans a whopping advantage. They make it harder to do voting, and now they want to take the right to cast a straight ticket away. It's conceivable this could backfire on Republicans in the voting booth, but they're betting that it won't, that it's too complex, and that people won't pay attention.
Michigan Radio's political commentator, Jack Lessenberry. Thanks so much, Jack.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of my sports-loving friends said this week, I'm so happy for the entire state of Michigan. Having Michigan and Michigan State doing so well is really great for everyone. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John U. Bacon is here, and that reminds me of what you often say, John, that all boats rise and the Spartans and Wolverines are really doing that.
Exactly right. Look, in the Big Ten, of course, you're always rooting for your team naturally, and you got rivalries. You hope for them to lose. It's a silly equation. Michigan State should hope for each team to win all but one game. And that's almost what's happening this year, actually.
It really is something. So the rankings that really count, the college football playoff rankings, we got Michigan State moving from 9th to 5th, Ohio State dropping from 3rd to 8th place, Michigan moved up from 12th to 10th. Any surprises there for you?
The big surprise is the one you missed, and that is Iowa at 3.
There.
So right now, get this, the Big Ten has got 4 teams in the all-important college football playoff rankings, 4 teams out of 10. The next closest is the Big 12 with 2, and the all-powerful SEC, which has been going on for 10 years, has got 1, Alabama, with 1 loss.
Wow.
So this, for the Big 10, is a huge triumph. Now, look, it's not going to be this way in a week because these teams play each other.
Yeah.
They're going to eat their own.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is a huge triumph for the Big 10.
First up on Saturday, Michigan against Ohio State. And boy, the Buckeyes got smacked in the face by the Spartans. We saw running back Zeke Elliott have a Twitter tantrum about the play calling and say, I'm going pro. What do you think that Ohio State locker room is like heading into this big game Saturday?
Poison. Look, Ezekiel, of course, is the star tailback for Ohio State. Michigan State goes down there with 1 loss. Ohio State has not lost a game in almost 2 years. They are the undefeated returning national champions. They got a very good chance to do it again. They have not lost a league game regulation since Urban Meyer took over in 2012. That's almost 4 seasons worth. State goes down there with a backup quarterback. He gets banged up. A third-string guy goes in for a little while, and they beat them at Ohio State with this backup system.
Yeah.
That is one of the best coaching jobs I have seen, and that's Mark D'Antonio, far by one of the worst ones I've seen out of Urban Meyer.
Was it complacent coaching? What was going on
there?
It was
scared, conservative play calling. Michigan State's weakness on defense is the defensive backs, which means you're supposed to pass, not run. And Ohio State ran almost constantly and very little passing, and everybody could see that, but surprisingly, the Ohio State coaches. So that will go down, mark my words, as one of the biggest wins in Michigan State history. That was colossal.
That was colossal. It was something to see, and without Connor Cook, who's still game, you know, he's a game day decision.
He's one of the best quarterbacks, they say, in the nation.
Talk about what you've seen as Jim Harbaugh has gotten his team ready this week for the game on Saturday.
They are, on paper, no more talented than last year's team that finished 5-7. In fact, you could argue is less so because you lost Devin Gardner, you lost some good seniors, some transfers. You've added almost nothing to this equation. And yet now they're 9-2 and a very impressive 9-2. Their 2 losses are probably the 2 quote-unquote best losses in the nation right now. 1 touchdown loss to Utah, a very good team, and of course the last second punt situation with Michigan State. So they not only have a better record, they are simply a much better team. They're playing better. They lost Michigan State this year as they did 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, Michigan had minus 48 yards rushing, which means you're better off not calling a play than running one.
That's
an old-fashioned butt kicking right there. So this team is now fully competitive, game in, game out. Not a great team still, but competitive.
And being coached well. And talk to us a little bit about last night's visit to Bo's grave.
Very cool. They've been doing this now for 20-some years. Jeff Holzien is the super fan from Michigan who runs this tour. I've been on this tour. I've spoken on this tour before. In the same graveyard right near campus is Fielding Yost's grave, Bo Schembechler's grave, Bob Ufer. A few of the Michigan greats are in there. And they go on this tour, which is what they've always been doing. This time, Jim Harbaugh came along for the walk.
And they didn't know he was there.
They did not know he was there, and he spoke there at the end. He said to a friend of mine who told him to go down there, he said the experience was A++++.
Unbelievable. Well, it'll be a big weekend. Once we get through Thanksgiving Day, a big weekend of games. John Eubakin, Michigan Radio Sports commentator and author of the best-selling End Zone, The Rise, Fall, and Return of Michigan Football. Happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Up next, author Rebecca Sherm takes us inside her debut suspense novel, Unbecoming.
So much of writing fiction for me is about taking a small feeling that I had once and pushing it to an extreme.
And then in 20 minutes, the next idea. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you've been pining for a book that will truly have you flipping through those pages to see how this story is going to turn out, a book that'll have you in suspense without having to resort to spilling buckets of blood, and a book that takes you deep into the heart and mind who's someone who is complex, brilliant, but broken, then here's your book, Unbecoming. It's the first novel from Ann Arbor-based writer Rebecca Sherm. She received her MFA from the University of Michigan, and that's where she now teaches freshman writing classes. Rebecca Sherm sat down with me to talk about Unbecoming earlier this year. So good to have you with us in Stateside, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
I gotta say, I loved the book. I'm going to be real open about that. I thought it was such a cool, intricate story, the way you wove together the past and the present of this very troubled and interesting young woman named Grace. I'd love to hear how you describe and see Grace.
Well, usually when people ask me that question, they're starting with the likability question. And so if I look at that from a different angle, I see Grace as someone whose true self is the chameleon. And ultimately, I think books that center around one person are trying to solve that person for us. And for Grace, the redemption and the sort of the variable in her is that she is a chameleon, is that she's never fully one person. And I think that's a very hard thing for me as a writer to make peace with. I think it's hard for the reader, too, but that was one of the reasons for the book.
That's what made it so interesting to me. I've seen your book described using the term an unbecoming of age story. What does that mean?
You know, we're very used to a coming of age story where the protagonist, or in my case, really the anti-heroine, makes a lot of mistakes on the way to becoming the right person. And since I was looking at sort of the making of the femme fatale, what interested me was what happens on the way to becoming the wrong person, if that person is really your true self.
Interesting. When we meet Grace, she's going by the name Julie and working at a little dingy subterranean shop in Paris, fixing and restoring broken antiques and trinkets, which is a very far cry from her little Tennessee hometown of Garland. And she's on the run and hiding in Paris because of a crime that sent her husband and another very important man in their lives to prison. And it was so striking to me what you have Grace doing for a living, fixing these broken treasures and antiques and making them whole because she's so broken and damaged herself.
Yeah, and you know, as a character, she can't tell the reader everything about herself. She's not willing to. And I can't force her to do that. It wouldn't be true to her. So in a way, having her repair these antiques became a way for me to communicate to the reader and for Grace to communicate to the reader some of the inner life that she's not willing to talk about.
And really, some of the other characters in the shop with her, like Hannah, very much the same way. And it was such an interesting way to kind of take us inside their minds without them just spilling it all out there. It was really, really interesting. You really do a beautiful job of taking us deep into the internal life of this woman who I think could be unlikable. And maybe some people would think she was, but I think because we see the damage done to her even as a small girl by her very uncaring parents, I kind of felt sympathetic for her as the story went on. Were you expecting or hoping for that reaction from your readers?
Well, I think everyone's going to react to her differently. But what really matters to me is that you feel in some moments like you could make the decisions that she makes and in other moments that you don't. For me, that's the really interesting tension. You know, we're used to heists as this heists as a trope, and we see them in movies often, and we read them in books. But when you see a heist on a screen, you're always very separate from the characters. You never forget that you're not committing the crime. But when you're reading a book, you disappear into the character, and you become complicit in that character's thoughts and actions, whether you want to or not. And one of the reasons that it was so important for me to make Grace this sort of femme fatale but real is that it forces us to look at our own darker impulses, and it forces us to look at decisions that we might make in desperate moments.
Who was your inspiration for Grace?
My inspiration for Grace isn't so much a person, but an idea, a sort of anger I had about the way the femme fatale is portrayed in fiction and in films, as a side character, as someone whose motivations are very clear and very simple. That's not real. Mm-hmm. That's a type. And I love that style of writing. And so I sort of began to feel like I had a responsibility to investigate the femme fatale and to give her a real character, to give her the spotlight, her own story.
Very interesting. I would love if you would read from Unbecoming for us, and particularly this part where you give us such rich background into Grace's early life and in some very, very well-drawn paragraphs.
Grace was not a Garland native. She had been born in Louisville, Kentucky. Her mother was 18, her father 19. They'd met at a party after a Van Halen concert, Grace's father once told her, but such details were rare. Her parents were unwilling to discuss anything before their marriage, before Garland, as though Grace had been a witness they'd expected to remain silent. Her father's parents had taken care of her until she was 3, while her father was in college and her mother was somewhere else. She'd never been told where. After that, Grace lived for varying stretches, some repeating, in North Carolina with her Aunt Regina and her kids, in Smyrna with her father after he dropped out of Tennessee State and took a job at the Nissan plant, in Paducah, Kentucky, with her mother and 2 other young women who, it turned out, were not willing to babysit their roommate's kid when she was kept late at work, in Memphis, briefly, when her father was married to a woman named Irene who had bald eyebrows and made Grace spaghetti sandwiches before her bartending shifts, outside Chattanooga with her mother and an older man named Alan who wore collared shirts tucked into chinos every day and had 2 grown children who did not seem to like Grace or her mother very much, and in Ocean City, Maryland, where Grace's mother was waitressing when Grace's father came up for the season to try to talk to her and make things right. Her father came in June, and by August, Grace's mother was pregnant. Her parents married, and together for the first time, they all marched back south to Garland. Grace was 9. She started 4th grade 2 weeks late and newly legitimate. When the teacher introduced her, Grace looked out from under her dark bangs and felt a thrill that not one of them knew who she had ever been before. Grace's family moved into a small, white-sided ranch house behind the grocery store. Her mother planted white begonias in circles around the 2 small trees in the yard, and her father surrounded them with dyed red mulch, which Grace noticed as soon as she noticed that the people in Garland's nicer neighborhoods used mulch that was brown or black. The house was nearly silent at first. The 3 of them had no idea how to interact. Any 2 people could be talking in a room, but when the 3rd entered, the conversation would fall apart, all parties self-conscious and suddenly overwhelmed. Grace had always read a lot, and she'd seen so many adult faces slacken with relief when they found her engrossed in a book or a magazine, as though she had unintentionally absented herself from whatever forgotten carpool pickup line or tense phone call was in the background. Now she disappeared into her books again, hoping to ease the pressure on her parents, who even she could see were struggling to play the roles they had finally submitted to. She spent long stretches of her childhood in fictional worlds, and trapped in this new and uneasy diorama, what was real and what wasn't began to seem uncertain. When Grace found a box of her father's secret detritus in the basement that included several photos of Irene, she was relieved to see that she had not imagined that whole episode, among others. And then the twins were born, identical colicky boys who absorbed her parents and family life completely. Her mother and father adored Aiden and Dryden. Their names, aspirational and slant-rhymed, embarrassed her before she knew why. With such obvious passion, imagining their thoughts and desires and fears before the boys could speak them. Her parents loved their baby boys in a way that even they had not expected. Grace had been practice for them, she concluded. She hadn't realized she was lonely until she began to understand that other people were not. Then she met Riley, and he brought her home to the Grahams.
Rebecca Sherm, reading from her first novel, Unbecoming. And Grace and Riley grow up together, and their love is really egged on by Riley's mother. And it was clear, I thought, that Mrs. Graham needed Grace as much as Grace needed a Mrs. Graham to be her mom. And I thought about that. It was such a powerful and important relationship in the story. And I'm betting most of us, as we grew up at one time or another, fantasized about being a member of someone else's family and how great that would be. Did you ever do that?
Yeah, you know, so much of writing fiction for me is about taking a small feeling that I had once and pushing it to an extreme. And I remember the first time I had that feeling. It was with my very first boyfriend. Well, very, you know, very short relationship. But when we broke up, I was so sad that I wouldn't get to see his mom or his dog anymore. He had this fabulous Labrador named Booger that I'd become very attached to. And I really missed his mom and his dog a lot more than I missed him.
I think it's very relatable. It really, really is. There's also a lot of the art world and antiques in your story and Paris. And I was wondering, how familiar were you with all of that? And did that help inspire the story, or did you have to plunge into learning so much about art and antiques and Paris?
I really had the art and antiques both ways. I'd grown up in a family that was very interested in simply old things. We toured historical houses, what felt to me in my youth, like constantly.
Because it's clear when you do go into the historical house in Garland, you've been through a lot of those kinds of...
And, you know, I actually, the first house that we ever lived in where I grew up in Kentucky, there was a historic house nearby. And so the idea of the historic house sort of looming in the neighborhood, that I think that was in my mind. And then I used to watch Antiques Roadshow every day with my grandmother when I would stay with her. And for me, it was a very suspenseful show. And as I got older, my interest in antiques sort of waned, but my interest in why people like them, or what it is that they're emotionally getting out of them, or what their attachment to the idea or the sort of class badge that antiques provide for them. I became much more interested in people's relationships to art and antiques than the antiques themselves.
You know, Rebecca, I've heard authors describe that they can sometimes be completely surprised by what happens with a character as they're writing the book, that the character is kind of pulling them along and that the author himself or herself doesn't necessarily realize such and so is going to happen. I was wondering, did that happen with you as you put this very complex tale together? Did you get surprised?
It happened to me often. When Grace would have moments of really high emotional stakes, I would be so wrapped up in what she was going through and what the characters around her were, how they were responding. There's a conversation between Grace and Mrs. Graham where Mrs. Graham confronts Grace about something that she's done. It was the hardest piece of writing. It was the hardest moment of writing I've ever had. I was really kind of messed up for days about it. And I had known a moment like that was coming, but I didn't know exactly what would happen. And there were other moments when Grace ran into her mother and Mrs. Graham in the drugstore.
Yeah.
I had no idea that was coming. But the character who surprised me every day, who I could never see very far ahead for, was Alls.
Mm-hmm. Alls being one of the school friends who does become, we don't want to give away lots of spoilers in that, but becomes important in the very central to the story. You're right. And even the going back and forth from the past to the present and weaving that together, technically, how did you do that? Did you have, you know, story cards up on the wall? Oh, you did?
It was hard. It was difficult. In the beginning, I experimented with lots of different structures for this book. And I did try to tell it straight through, but I can't tell a story straight through to save my life, it seems. But really, I think that this story had to be told this way. And I began to think of it Maybe because I used to be a visual artist, I like to see, I see writing often in terms of visual shapes. And Unbecoming is shaped like a zipper. It has a left side, which is the past, and it has a right side, which is the present, and it has all these little teeth on either side, and neither side makes sense until it's linked up with the other side. And once I realized that, oh, it's a zipper. One tooth at a time, you have to link these pieces together until they become something whole. Then I knew what I was doing with it.
What is your writing routine? Because I know you're juggling the demands of teaching, and then you're writing this very complicated first novel. How'd you do it?
Well, with this, I was very, very fortunate that I had a fellowship from the University of Michigan for a year after I finished my MFA, the Zell Fellowship. And so for a year, I worked on almost nothing but this novel. And I would get up every morning and I would read. Unlike a lot of writers, I can't write first thing in the morning. I'm just not smart enough yet. So in the morning, I absorb. I read research. I sort of conduct research in the experiments that I need, or read other novels. And then when everyone else in the world is feeling sort of sleepy and stupid after lunch, that's my best time. And I write like a mad woman from about 2 o'clock to about 6 p.m.
Do you have a home office? Do you write at?
I have had desks. I have had very nice little desk setups for myself. It doesn't matter. I always write at the kitchen table or at the dining table or whatever the table is that's the closest to the kitchen. That's where I end up doing all of my writing.
It feels good.
Well, it feels good, and I like to be close to the snacks.
There you go. What do you love about just the act of writing?
For me, it's the satisfaction of discovery or of solving a psychological problem. Writing this novel felt like untangling a dense psychological knot where all of these strands of different people and ideas and concerns and little bits of anger that I had were all woven into this one dense knot, and I was just sort of teasing it apart for years. And every now and then, you have this moment of understanding where either the character understands something about the world or you understand something about the character. And for me, that's just euphoric.
As I read your novel, and it was the kind of thing I was so happy to dive back into it each evening after work. I kept seeing this. You have a real good way of writing that makes me feel like I'm watching it. And I just wondered, you're so descriptive in that. Would you be intrigued and interested in seeing this become something cinematic?
Oh, well, I see it that way too. And I think the reason that I see this novel often so cinematically, even as I was writing it, is because it's so influenced by heist films.
Such as
To Catch a Thief and Rififi. I think even 90s movies like The Thomas Crown Affair or the older Thomas Crown Affair. I think that we have these images of what a heist looks like and what a caper looks like that we can't pretend don't exist. And these characters are as influenced by those stories, by these narratives that are familiar to us, as we are. I can't imagine that there's anyone out there who's planning some elaborate heist who isn't in some way imagining themselves in a movie.
That's true. Well, you never know. You never know. I know the book has literally just been released. Is it too early to ask what your next project might be?
You know, I'm hard at work on my next project because I'm not happy unless I'm writing something. And on one hand, it seems very different. It's about an American family living on a space station. But on the other hand, I see so many familiar concerns that I'm not done with about deception between people who are close to each other and identity. And maybe these are themes that I'll be working out for a long time.
They really do create suspense, but I was appreciative that we didn't have to see blood spilled and gore and violence, but there is a real sense of suspense, and you really did a great job getting that across.
So, thank you so much.
Congratulations. Rebecca Sherm, her first novel is Unbecoming. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Ann Arbor-based writer Rebecca Sherm speaking about her debut novel, Unbecoming. The book comes out in paperback December 1st. Coming up, why you don't need to fear cheap turkeys.
Things like young, hormone-free, and cage-free, for example, are completely meaningless.
That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Our infrastructure is our collective ability to say what we care about.
Last spring, Detroit Future City launched its Ideas for Innovation series of community conversations. They were searching for ideas and solutions to challenges that we face, particularly in Southeast Michigan. The conversations have looked at questions such as use of open spaces, strengthening Detroit neighborhoods, equitable growth. The latest event explored regional cooperation. Dan Kincaid is back with us now. Dan's Director of Initiatives at Detroit Future City. Good to have you back on The Next Idea, Dan.
Thank you very much.
And we welcome back John Austin, President of the State Board of Education and the Director of the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas. Always good to see you, John.
Good to see you, Cynthia.
Dan, we have actually talked about more regional cooperation in Southeast Michigan, I think literally for decades, but little has actually materialized. What is the case to be made for a shared regional vision?
You know, I think it's a good question. The answer really lies in the fact that our future, all of us together in the region, is really incumbent upon us coming together to shape a shared vision. We know together now that the consequences are great, that we have huge opportunities, huge opportunities for gains in the region, but huge opportunities for losses. And these, you know, if you think about it, the reality for us within the Detroit region has been shaped by political dissonance over the years and a lot of infighting, but we've also begun to realize how we as a city and as a region are positioned within the Great Lakes, within a larger region of about 48 million people, nestled adjacent to 84% of the North American fresh surface water supply. And we have tremendous natural assets here, and we have tremendous economic and intellectual assets that are present. And I think many of us are beginning to realize how we can really, you know, fully utilize these to our benefit and, quite honestly, to global benefit.
John, what are your thoughts?
Agree with Dan. You know, we have had so many challenges that are kind of a legacy of us creating and dominating and enjoying great wealth from the industrial era. But we're in a new era where we need to turn our tremendous innovation abilities in our universities, our companies, our people, and put our technological and other know-how to work solving the problems of tomorrow, creating new jobs in the coming arenas of solving the world's food, energy, water, transportation, as it's understood as mobility system building. That takes a lot of work together to clean up the mess we made from the industrial era, reconnect to our water and to our land.
It takes a sense of teamwork, and I've got to put this out here. At the start of 2014, we had Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson, who gave that now infamous quote about Detroit in the story in The New Yorker. The headline of the story was "Drop Dead Detroit." And among other things, Brooks Patterson was quoted, and here's his quote, "I made a prediction a long time ago, and it's come to pass. I said, what we're going to do is turn Detroit into an Indian reservation where we herd all the Indians into the city, build a fence around it, and then throw in the blankets and the corn." So when you've got the head of Oakland County saying something like that, people pushing for more regional cooperation have some pretty rough sledding. Is racism the only thing to blame for our lack of a shared regional vision? I'll let you start, Dan.
No, I don't think racism is the only thing. I think very parochial and naive thinking is woven within it. I think what we've realized is that there are many other cities and regions that have now moved past us at an incredible speed. And now we're looking at them and figuring out how we can catch up. You know, if you look at places like Denver or Minneapolis-St. Paul and the larger land use policy they've been able to develop, a larger regional transportation system that they've been able to develop, all of these things could have been present for us earlier. But today we're in a position where we're trying to regain some momentum and really, honestly, kind of change course. You know, today, of course, we have the RTA, the Regional Transit Authority, which is fantastic. But, of course, it comes on the heels of really decades of really divisive decision-making. If you look back to 1976, when we were beginning to put forth a federal play for funding for a regional light rail transportation system, we had tremendous opportunities in front of us that could put us in a very different position. That entire system across all three counties would have been complete by 1992. It would have informed land use policy and investment in a way that we've just not seen. And now we kind of have to get there. Now we're the region that ranks number one for job sprawl, right? So as we think about repositioning key assets, as John has highlighted, we also have to understand how we can reposition ourselves within, you know, within the region and within the larger country, and begin to take full advantage of everything that we have. But we have to bring people together. And I think more and more the folks that I connect to, and I'm sure the folks that John connects to, we're seeing this happen again and again and again. It's really a matter of time, and that time is exponentially quickening.
John, is it your hope that we stop hearing people say things like Brooks Patterson said to The New Yorker?
Yeah, I think we have to be honest and acknowledge how we got where we are. Another thing that makes it challenging, because if we could start over, we'd probably design regional transportation systems, regional water infrastructure, regional parks. Our governments were created, just the structure of our governments were created 200 plus years ago with Jeffersonian democracy as the model. The Northwest Ordinance that platted the politics, the political organization of the Upper Midwest, said we want lots of local governments close to the people. So we have all these cities and townships, thousands of them in Michigan and the states of the Upper Midwest. And that worked fine when the Battle Creeks and the Jacksons could grow and they could pay for and begin to get their own resources to pay for parks and fire and police and sanitation and build that out. But then what's happened is that with the people and businesses leaving our core cities and some of our inner ring suburbs, they have no way to pay for the basic services and the infrastructure. And it's really hard to find ways to consolidate or to merge those functionalities. And that's one of the big challenges for us looking ahead. We've got to fix our broken finance system for our cities and our governments if we're going to create communities that are attractive places to live, work, and raise a family.
You actually gave us a very good taste of what your essay is for The Next Idea, that we're, this way we fund our municipalities and all of these layers with the cities and townships and the counties, it's balkanizing our state and really holding us back from a more shared regional vision.
Yeah, and we need to be competitive and have communities that aren't falling apart. As I said, for many of our older cities and inner ring suburbs, they are continuing to get hammered by a broken finance system. They get their resources from one of three ways. One is local property taxes. That's about half. We've also been cutting revenue sharing. We have state revenue sharing where we share some of our generalized taxes. That has continued to be cut $600 million every year, and it's continuing. And you can't have fees and fines on parking tickets, which is what makes up the rest.
Dan, what other opportunities do you see and challenges do you see?
Well, on the opportunity side, I think people are recognizing the fact that we can begin to work together at a few levels. We've highlighted the RTA. The fact that three-county millage was passed to support the DIA is another example. But I think we really need to shift into some more of the active decision-making on the ground regarding development to make this really matter, because even today, and a lot of folks have highlighted this, the fact that we have 10,000 new housing starts each year above what the market will bear across the region. And we're dealing with cities that have an abundance of housing units that are running vacant, open, and dangerous. We need to have an understanding of where we need to emphasize development, where we need to emphasize open space. We need to realize that there's a huge ecological balance here and that we cannot continue to fund the gray infrastructure systems at scale that we funded in the past, and that instead we have an opportunity to embrace new green infrastructure systems that help us mitigate the impact of our combined sewer system that overflows when we get a little over half an inch of rain in less than an hour. We can begin to address these things through these green systems at a regional scale and have an impact, quite honestly, that many other cities can't. The stakes are very high for us. It extends outside the borders of Detroit and certainly the region to the entire Great Lakes region, and we need to recognize that burden and live up to it.
And with that in mind, the stakes that you refer to, final thoughts, how do you think we will lose if we can't get it together to really define a shared regional vision, John?
We won't put in place the kind of assets that competitive global metropolitan communities have. Young people want to live in communities where you can take the bike, you can take the transit, you can take the rail. That means finding the ways to regionally finance systems that now need to work in the 21st century, different from Jeffersonian's day, on a regional basis. And there are some creative approaches that I talked about in my essay about how we can get to regional financing of some of these important infrastructures and enablers of a better functional and more attractive community.
Dan, what price will we pay?
I think we'll pay a very steep price. We'll pay one that will be seen in our children leaving, right, and not returning, looking for opportunities in other urban areas. I think we're also going to really lose an opportunity to fully leverage the Great Lakes asset that we have in front of us, and perhaps lose some of the key partners that are around us. And these include folks coming out of Cleveland. There's folks there that are pushing an idea forward, and I think you guys might have just covered this on the next idea, looking at the Lake Erie Crescent, right, and understanding how we actually cross not only county lines and city lines, but even state lines to understand how we organize ourselves around these key assets that are here. We'll lose those opportunities, too. We have a huge differentiating asset in place in Metro Detroit. We need to fully leverage it. If we can't, we're going to fall behind.
You'll find John Austin's essay at the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. Dan Kincaid, Detroit Future City. John Austin, State Board of Education President and Director of the Michigan Economic Center at Prima Civitas. Always great to talk to both of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
As we draw ever nearer to the annual Thanksgiving feast, those whose feast must include turkey may find themselves inclined to want to pay more for a bird advertised with some special buzzwords. But here's Detroit News Finance Editor Brian J. O'Connor. He's got some advice that could help protect your wallet. And Brian, your column in the Detroit News poses the question, cage-free turkey? You say you'll take one that's malarkey-free. What do you mean by that?
Well, as it turns out, you know, I was looking at sort of the economics of Thanksgiving, and the ASPCA had sent around a notice that was talking about, you know, there's a lot of these labels that you'll find on turkey that really seemed more appropriate on a weasel. things like young, hormone-free, and cage-free, for example, are completely meaningless. The USDA doesn't let poultry growers give turkeys hormones, so they're all hormone-free. The turkeys aren't grown in cages anyway, raised in cages in the U.S., and they're all young. No turkey farmer is going to keep turkeys around long enough that they start worrying about their pension. They're not like a Cabernet. They're not better after 10 years. It's just kind of like saying, you know, gluten-free toilet paper. I mean, they're completely meaningless.
But they cost more, right?
They can use that to try and jack up the cost, you know, because some of these factory farm conditions can be really appalling. And there are also legitimate efforts and endorsements that people are making to try and say, hey, you know what, the food that we raise should be raised more respectfully and more humanely. But it just leads to this thing where you can kind of, you know, say cage-free, and you picture your turkey out wandering through a field picking daisies, and, you know, it really doesn't mean anything because they're all cage-free.
That's interesting. So what does the ASPCA suggest if we really, you know, do want to support a better standard of living for our turkey? What phrases should we look for?
There's a lot of these labels that actually mean something, but they're actually very vague. Natural, naturally raised is kind of undefined by the USDA. Free range and organic are also wildly interpretive. But there are three that they said are really good ones, especially if you're worried about the humane treatment of your entree. One is certified humane, which is verified by auditors. They have outdoor access. They have adequate space. They might have perches. They have bedding that's dark enough that they can get to sleep and things like that. There's another one that's also verified by auditors called the Global Animal Partnership, which has a six-step rating program for animals that are raised for meat. They get more space, they get more air, and that kind of thing. And then there's another one that's animal welfare approved, which is also verified by auditors. The birds have access to pasture or range. They don't get antibiotics. And there's other standards about transport and slaughtering and things like that. The bottom line is that, you know, I mean, how humane is it really? Nobody thinks these turkeys died in their sleep of old age. I mean, they're raised to be slaughtered at a convenient time so that they can be featured in Kroger. How they get raised and how they sort of meet their end, you know, is a concern for a lot of people. But I mean, I guess if you're really concerned about that, you know, you would just, you know, have Brussels sprouts.
Now, speaking of what's going to be on the table, there were a lot of headlines about turkey prices are going to be at an all-time high, avian flu. What are you seeing as you're going into stores?
When I looked up the prices at the USDA, they hit a high of $1.38 a pound for frozen turkeys for delivery. So that might be an all-time high, but it's still not very expensive, which is one of the things I think one of the mistakes people have when they write about this. You know, I remember last spring or the spring before, it was, you know, steak-ageddon because beef prices were through the roof because so much animal feed was being diverted for use in ethanol. But when you looked at it, the average price of a nice New York strip that you were going to put on the grill was maybe going to cost you another $1.50.
Okay.
So a lot of times with these food things, when you see percentages where writers have gone off the rails about, oh my God, 38% increase in, you know, lamb for Easter, it's not going to turn out to be a real budget buster for most people. I think the other thing is that at this time of year, turkey is just cheap. It's completely different from what you think of the supply and demand economics you learned in high school. What happens is grocers are using these as loss leaders, and they want you to pay a lot of money for the crispy fried onions that you're going to throw on that green bean glop or for pumpkin spice or things like that. And to get you in the door, they're basically coming close to giving the turkeys away. I just paid 59 cents a pound for almost a 20-pound turkey last night, and I doubt that the grocery store made any money on that thing. What they want me to buy is the appetizers and the cream cheese for the spread and everything else that's going to go with that.
So your advice seems to be don't be afraid to go with the cheap birds.
No, especially if you were being worried about them being, you know, caged and hormone fed. The frozen bowling ball is just as good as the thing you're going to get at the hippy-dippy market, if that's the only label that you're looking at. And if you do really care about that stuff, then look up the certifications that are relevant to the things that you're concerned about. If it's antibiotics, if it's how the birds are humanely handled, are they really organic? You know, do some research and just don't get taken in by, you know, these weasel words that can show up on a label that says, you know, natural, free range, raised by mammals.
Detroit News finance editor Brian J. O'Connor with some financial advice as we craft our Thanksgiving feast. Always great talking with you, Brian. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Shelley Smith. Joe Lindstroth is producer of The Next Idea. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty, and from all of us here at Stateside, have a very, very happy Thanksgiving Day.